It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it'll be Food Friday, and we'll speak with a pastry chef about making the perfect pie.
But first, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed yesterday just above 16,000 for the first time ever.
Optimism around the Senate Banking Committee's approval of Janet Yellen's nomination as the Federal Reserve Chair, as some positive jobless reports, they both got some of the credit for the record high. Joining us now to talk about this is Robin Farzad. He covers Wall Street for Bloomberg Business Week. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hello, cheesehead.
So, this is not cheesy news. 16,000. I wonder, is this milestone just kind of a psychological boost for Wall Street people, or is this really a big deal?
It's not really a big deal for the broader investing populace, which is largely missed out if you look at the big numbers over the past full run of the 4 years, which is a period with which investors withdrawn a record $400 billion from stock funds. And they're only now piling back into the market in true buy high, sell low fashion.
So it's a big number for Wall Street, but doesn't make that much difference for the populace at large. How far detached are those two things from each other, the number on the Dow and what the rest of us experience in our daily economic lives?
Well, the last time we really saw the two married, for better or for worse, was in the housing boom, where Wall Street was churning out mortgage-related securities and Main Street was enjoying this epic boom in housing prices, and we know how that ended up. And the last time we saw it before that was the dot-com bubble, when everybody was talking about the market and it was fodder for cocktail parties and salons. And if you watch The Sopranos, Carmela Soprano said she wanted to, you know, that she watched CNBC. There's nothing like that for the past 13 years, and yet we get this jarring number yesterday that we've seen this year, the biggest inflow into stock funds since the year 2000.
Well, as you say, the last time the market was high and Main Street did well, it was a bubble. Is a big number like this on the Dow in and of itself a bubble? Or is this something that's going to burst, say, if the Federal Reserve stops goosing the economy?
That's the $3.5 trillion a day right now. I'm saying that because that's the amount of stimulus that the Fed has thrown at this economic crisis for the past 4 or 5 years. Let's not forget that interest rates have been at zero, rock bottom levels, since December of 2008. And then the Federal Reserve followed that up with quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3, effectively throwing conjured money at the situation. And if you plot those numbers against one another, the S&P 500 and Dow versus the size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, they track pretty closely.
And I had mentioned the nomination of Janet Yellen as the Federal Reserve Chair, moving along, Federal Reserve playing a role in the economic performance here. How big a deal is it? Who is at the top? Who's the boss at the Fed?
It's seen as a continuation. Janet Yellen is not a greenhorn to the Fed. I mean, after all, she was vice chairman. She's been very on the record as being simpatico with the Bernanke consensus of the past 4 or 5 years, which within the Fed is even controversial. You have renegade Fed governors who, if one of those guys, for example, the Richmond Fed president where I am, is much more of an iconoclast. Had he been appointed somehow, or had Mitt Romney won and appointed, I believe it was a professor at Stanford who was much more hawkish in terms of interest rates, then you could see the stock and bond markets take a hit.
Okay, and the Fed always has to balance their famous conundrum: is our main job to keep inflation low or to keep unemployment low? And balancing those two things against each other, do you see any kind of change in priority there in coming months?
Well, because they've taken on such experimental campaigns, again, $3.5 trillion of quantitative easing, that they might have to change their bogey, because the stock market has detached really from unemployment rate. Maybe in the past they would track more closely, but the stock market has had far bigger gains at the same time that unemployment has been chronically high and the economy's been growing rather tepidly coming out of an economic crisis of this size, where you would expect a bigger bounce back. So if you see another asset bubble, if you see junk bonds take off, you see real estate in certain markets taking off again, the Fed is going to be criticized in hindsight if it didn't do something to pop that bubble before we had to deal with the problem, say, 10 years from now.
If the Dow has become so unmoored from daily economic life in some ways, are there other indicators that you like to watch that give us a better taste of what life is like, the economic life outside of Wall Street?
somebody should really look at the use of food stamps in this country, which is still at a record, in spite of the fact that the financial meltdown occurred between the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009. So, yes, Wall Street has reconstituted itself. Housing is back in certain markets. But this is very much a story of how the other half lives. Still, if you go out and seek out economic pain indicators, there are people out there who have experience. There are kids out of college who have degrees that can't get jobs. You have a record number of 22-year-olds living with their parents. So don't pay too much attention to the Dow. It's one thing that should be considered almost in isolation.
So one indicator that maybe was a goose for the Dow was some better unemployment numbers this week. Not awesome still. I guess that's the same storyline we've been seeing for weeks and even months. Are there things you're looking at that show any kind of overall bigger growth in employment?
There was a better than expected payroll number that we got most recently, but it's nothing on the order of the hundreds of thousands of jobs sustainably we'd have to create every month to bring this unemployment rate back down to the 5% territory, which, after all, they used to call the natural rate of unemployment. But we haven't heard that now for 5 or 6 years, just to underscore how deep this recession has been.
All right, Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. I love Wisconsin.
Oh, great. Well, stop on by and see us sometime. That's Robin Farzad. He covers Wall Street for Bloomberg Businessweek.
Coming up, pastry chef Michelle Stewart will tell us how to make the perfect Thanksgiving pie. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, it's time now for Food Friday, and with Thanksgiving right around the corner, we thought we'd look up some expert help.
Our next guest is a national pie baking champion, and she's got some great tips to inspire us in our pie making efforts.
Joining us now is Michelle Stewart. She's a pastry chef and author of Perfect Pies and More. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you to have me. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're talking pies, which is something a lot of people look forward to on the Thanksgiving table. And in terms of, you know, the daunting factor of pies, is it hard to pull off a great pie?
It's not hard to pull it off. It's just a lot of practice and patience and love and determination, and you'll get it.
Well, one thing I like about your book is that you divvy it up into easy, I think moderate or medium, and challenging pies. So there's a stepladder there. What is an easy pie for the novice?
An easy pie is like really any of the fruit pies that you make. We use all fresh fruit, so there's really no reason to overmask it with seasoning and whatnot. So it's really just a few seasonings and cutting up the fruit and placing it into your pie shell. And then if you want to make it even easier, just make it with a crumb topping, and you don't have to deal with rolling out the pastry, you know, the pastry top, if you're too intimidated to do that.
Well, speaking of intimidation, I am intimidated by the pie crust, and I've even read, you know, fancy articles about the secret to the perfect pie crust. And I have to tell you, it's never been easy for me, and it ends up like little piles of shred of dough, and I have to kind of push them together, and they look like a little gobbledygook. So what can we do to make pie crust better?
Well, one of the most important things is to keep your ingredients cold and make sure, you know, I use Crisco or vegetable shortening. Make sure it's nice and cold so that it doesn't kind of melt into the flour mixture as you're trying to mix it. I like to use my fingertips when I'm mixing it, so this way I have control over how much I'm mixing it rather than a blender where, you know, you could, you know, have a good chance of over-mixing it. I also like to use ice-cold water when you're adding your water, you know, 1 tablespoon at a time. You don't want to add all your water at once or else you'll not be able to add it all because it'll be too gooey and you won't be able to mix it in properly. So, and I like to use a marble rolling pin when you roll it out because then this way you can keep your rolling pin in the refrigerator, keep it nice and cold, and this way, you know, you can keep your whole crust nice and cold as you're rolling it out as well.
Michelle, I'm going to make a confession. I keep my crust very cold because I buy it in the freezer section at the grocery. should I be ashamed or should I be okay with using that frozen pie crust?
You know, I always tell people if it's between you making the crust and not making the crust, go for it. And, you know, or I mean making the pie and not
right.
making the pie, just go for it. So rather than not making it at all.
Do you have an alternative to Crisco if someone doesn't want to use Crisco? Does butter work?
I honestly have never used a butter crust. I grew up baking with Crisco, and that was kind of like our standby, as my grandmother taught me. And
what does Crisco give you that some other stuff wouldn't?
It just makes for a really flaky golden pie crust, kind of like melts in your mouth. And you can actually see it when you roll it out. You'll see the marbleization of it, and that's what will give you the flakiness.
Now, speaking of cooking with your family growing up, pie is really one of those tradition foods often handed down. When you're trying something new, how do you balance the element of tradition on the one hand with the need to make something fresh and fun and new on the other?
I think it's just really, it's families have their own baking traditions. So it's kind of like something that's passed down from one generation to the next. It's, you know, that's what's in your family. But it's always great to try something new as well. But you can keep the old traditions within the baking circle as well.
Now, we have some pumpkin pie, haters in my family. But I think that the Thanksgiving table is not complete with a pumpkin pie on it. But you have kind of an alternative. It's still a pumpkin pie, but it's got a little twist, a pumpkin meringue pie. And I should point out that we're going to post this recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about your pumpkin meringue pie.
That's really good because the pumpkin, you know, we use all fresh pumpkin. We process about 6,000 pounds of pumpkin a year. And that, first off, makes, like, a big difference. I don't know if you've never tried it. I strongly suggest it because it's more fruity tasting, and you really don't have to put too many spices in it because you're getting the taste of the true pumpkin. So that's, first off, like, that's what makes this pie special. But if you want to use a can, you can as well if you have a time saver. But it's, you know, great because this pie has, like, you know, the traditional pumpkin spices, and then you just add a little twist by putting a meringue on top.
I like what you're saying about not overdoing the spices because I really like the natural flavor of pumpkin and a little sugar. It doesn't seem like you need to go too overboard. Does that hold true for a lot of pies, not just pumpkin?
It does, yep. When you're using, like, fresh peaches or berries. And, you know, another thing that makes sense when you're using all fresh fruit is sometimes the fruit is a little sweeter than others, so I always suggest to taste the fruit before you actually season it, or before you add the sugar and stuff, because you may not need to add as much sugar.
I've gone the other way. Sometimes I make things that end up being so tart they make you pucker because tart apples or whatever.
Yep, that's why I always say to try the fruit.
I want to go back to the pumpkin meringue pie because we haven't talked about the meringue part yet, which is what makes this special. So you're beating your egg whites, I assume. And what does it taste like then? What does it taste like to have meringue instead of whipped cream on top of your pie?
It's almost like a creamy, but it's not cream. It's really good. It kind of cuts down on the taste, you know, of the spices and kind of all melts together, and it's really good.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah, and it's a great showpiece for your table.
Excellent. Well, that might, give the pumpkin pie a little kick in the pants for people who are a little bored with it.
Yep.
Now you have to make it, Veronica, and report back. Or better yet, bring the second one in for us to try.
I may just do that, actually. It looks beautiful. And again,
in my first book, we have a pumpkin pie with a maple pumpkin with pecan streusel, which is really popular.
Oh, maple. So do you just add some maple syrup to your filling?
Mm-hmm. It's a little different mixture. It's maple syrup and some brown sugar and cinnamon, nutmeg. And then we bake the pumpkin, and then you add the streusel towards the end of the baking. And it's like a brown sugar, butter, pecan streusel.
Ooh, that sounds delicious, too. What else do you think belongs on a Thanksgiving table when it comes to pies?
Well, of course, apples. Those are traditional. One of our biggest sellers in the store is our chocolate pecan bourbon pie, because that's my signature pie. But any sort of, like, apple, pumpkin, and a pecan of some sort.
There's a traditional pumpkin, apple pie, sorry. Have you done anything funky with apples to make a really different kind of distinct apple pie?
One of our popular pies is like an apple caramel crumb pie. So it's kind of, you got a little layer of caramel on the bottom, then you got your apples, and then you have a crumb topping that's topped with some caramel as well. So that's a fun, kind of a kid-friendly. I mean, every kid loves that apple pie, but that seems to be a popular one.
Can you talk us through some variations on toppings that we could try? Meringue is one. What else do you think might work?
Well, it depends if you're using, you know, for a fruit pie, you could do, crumb topping. We have a walnut crumb topping in the book, a coconut macadamia crumb topping. If you don't want to do the pastry crust, you could do like a lattice crust to make it more attractive. If you were doing a cream pie, you could do different kinds of whipped cream. We have like a maple whipped cream. You could do a chocolate whipped cream.
We did maple whipped cream one year. That was really delicious and pretty easy. It was lovely to have.
Yeah, that was great, too. Like, if you wanted to do just a traditional pumpkin pie, you can make some maple whipped cream pie, you know, maple whipped cream to put on top.
So speaking
with your apple pie, it's good.
You mentioned the kid-friendly pies. You've also got a recipe for an Oreo pie in the book.
Yes, that's my son's absolute favorite pie.
Aha. How does that work?
It's really good. It's an Oreo cookie crust, and then it's got hot fudge on the bottom, and it's vanilla cream that's cooled and mixed with whipped cream and Oreo bits and whipped cream on top and topped with crumbled Oreos and hot fudge.
Okay, that sounds crazily good.
Yeah, every kid that I know requests that for their birthday.
Really? So kids will eat pie for their birthday instead of birthday cake if it's good enough?
Yeah, and in the book we also have a birthday cake pie, which is basically a cake in a pie shell.
Oh, there's a picture in your book, and it does look spectacular. Hot fudge on the bottom. So that I like the idea of maybe mixing traditional and non-traditional at Thanksgiving. There's no law that says you have to have pumpkin and sweet potato and pecan.
Nope, of course not.
Will you be trying anything different?
I bake thousands of pies for Thanksgiving. I take whatever's left.
You get the ones that didn't sell as well. They end up on your Thanksgiving table. Great. And they're still good, though.
Yes. Everything we make is good for our holiday menu.
Well, getting back to crusts and the more non-traditional kind, here's one that struck me as different. I've been seeing a lot of pretzel rolls in stores, pretzel this and that. You've got a pretzel crust for pies.
I paired that with the candy bar pie because I think, sweet and salty at the same time is a great combination.
Yeah, that whole salt and caramel thing everybody's doing, I think.
Yep. Yeah, so you can really work whatever kind of your favorite candy bars into that pie.
And is the starch crumble just like a graham cracker crust, except you're crumbling up pretzels?
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Well, since we're talking with a pie baking expert, I want to mine you a little bit more about crusts, my arch nemesis, the crust. What do you think about, those things at specialty food stores that shield the edges so they don't burn? Are they necessary?
I don't think so. I've never used them, and every time I try to use them, I break the crust. So, I mean, even if you just have some tinfoil on hand, and if you find the top part of your crust is getting a little too dark, you can always just top it with some tinfoil.
What about pie weights?
Those are necessary if you're making a cream pie or something that you need to pre-bake the crust with. I always put a piece of parchment paper in the bottom of the pie crust, and then I fill it with the pie weights, and you want to fill it to where your crimping starts. So that this way, when you bake the crust doesn't fall in.
Mm. So one thing that I loved reading your book, it gave me a burst of sanity.
Just a burst.
A burst. Ovens, the temperature of ovens and the cooking time varies, and you can't take recipes literally. Do I have that right?
Yes. That's what I found when I started my business. I baked, out of my condo up in Vermont, and I went through three different ovens, and all three ovens actually worked totally different from each other. So I really relied on the oven thermometer.
Yeah, that used to drive me nuts. I'm too lazy to get an oven thermometer, but the cooking times would vary so much from the recipe. I thought, what, am I doing something wrong? Did I make the initial recipe wrong?
And I'll get phone calls too. Well, you say 15 minutes. Well, and I always try to explain to people that, the ovens are, every oven's different.
Every oven is different. So you just watch for doneness? Is that the idea?
Yep, and, it's an estimated time, which is in the recipe. So you kind of go off of that, but, it depends, too, if you're baking with an electric oven or a gas oven or propane. It's all different.
All right. Leave us with a pie that is really easy to make but really impresses the heck out of people when we bring it to the event.
I would say, any of our, in the one of my favorites is the turtle pecan pie. That's a really good pie, and it's really not all that difficult to make. And it's traditional pecan, but it's got, caramel and chocolate in it.
And what about, for people who in your family who might be cutting down on sugar, maybe they're diabetic, what about sugar-free pies? Do they still taste good?
They do, especially when you're using fresh fruit. I mean, you're really getting more of the flavors from the fruit rather than, what the seasoning of it is.
So a fruit pie would be the way to go for thinking sugar-free.
Yeah, yep. I mean, you could do cream pies, too, but, they're not as good when you can't top it with the fresh whipped cream. You can. You're making fresh whipped cream, but they're not, sweetened with the confectionery sugar and the right yumminess that goes with it.
So maybe something like berries, raspberries, strawberries, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm, yep. Or even apple, and there's a pumpkin pie sugar-free recipe in the book.
All right, Michelle, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Michelle Stewart. Her book is Perfect Pies and More. And remember, we've got a recipe of hers. It was the pumpkin meringue pie, right? On the Central Time Facebook page. Check it out. Make it. Freeze it. Mail it to us.
It's a little self-serving. Yes, it looks delicious, so check that out. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll visit a new facility that turns a cheese plant's wastewater into energy. It's part of our series next week on sustainability.
We'll kick off a week-long Wisconsin Life food series in celebration of Thanksgiving. We'll hear about native food traditions in Wisconsin.
We'll also hear the story of the Automotive X Prize and the teams of engineers who are trying to build the car of the future.
That's all coming up Monday on Central Time.
Still to come today on Central Time, we'll talk with a guest who makes a case for investing locally and how it could help communities and your wallet. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest says we should invest more of our money locally.
First, many Wisconsin soldiers were killed or wounded at Civil War battle sites. Now, preservations are worried that urban sprawl and business development are threatening to nibble away at some of that famous land. WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach reports.
150 years after the Battle of Chickamauga, the city of Waukesha remembered the fight at a ceremony this fall. Waukesha and the battle site near Chattanooga, Tennessee, are 700 miles apart and might not seem to have a close connection. But here at a Civil War monument outside the Waukesha Library, Craig Wheeler starts to make the link by reading the monument's inscription.
Erected in honor of the men who faithfully served our country in the War for the Union, 1861-1865.
Wheeler is a member of Sons of Union Veterans of the Civil War. He goes on to explain the Waukesha Monument was dedicated in 1911 on the mid-September anniversary of the Chickamauga Battle due to the high number of Wisconsin soldiers killed or wounded.
There were four infantry regiments, three artillery batteries, and a cavalry regiment, and they all suffered heavy casualties in that engagement.
Including, Wheeler says, Colonel Hans Christian Hegg, who was killed. A statue of Hegg is outside the state capitol in Madison. Margie Say's great-great-grandfather, Thomas Thompson, served under Hegg and was wounded at Chickamauga. Say says Thompson's sacrifice and that of her military-serving father, uncle, and husband make her proud.
You know, without them, freedom would be less. Our freedoms would be fewer.
Chickamauga wasn't the only fight near Chattanooga with strong connections to Wisconsin. 150 years ago this coming Monday, the Battle of Missionary Ridge took place. As part of the action, Wisconsin soldier Arthur MacArthur grabbed a regimental flag and led a charge, by most accounts yelling, "On Wisconsin!" His accomplishment is noted in a film that plays in a museum near the battle site.
Arthur MacArthur of the Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry will receive the Medal of Honor for his heroic conduct on Missionary Ridge.
The film also notes that MacArthur's son was General Douglas MacArthur. Some preservationists say the bravery at the Civil War battlefields of Chattanooga is in danger of being diminished by a growing haze of noise and development around the military parks. The Chickamauga battlefield is hardly a quiet sanctuary now as a busy North Georgia highway runs through it. But there are worries about more businesses and suburban homes being built nearby, potentially preventing more discoveries about the battles. Private fundraising is going on to try to protect additional land, but Don Barger of the National Parks Conservation Association worries about federal dollars not being there to help maintain any more purchases. He says being cheap on battlefield preservation now would not bode well for the next century and a half.
I think what we're seeing is 150 years out, we have a few last chances to get as much as we can to tell the story as best we can 150 years from now.
The idea of additional protection of Civil War battlefields sounds good to Wisconsinites like Margie Say, the descendant of wounded Union soldier Thompson.
Besides the Revolutionary War, this is one of the main battles that our country has had here on its own soil.
Say says the historical sites can also be a place for solemn thought, peace, and much-needed green space. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Wisconsin is a big part of the local food scene, but did you know that we're also a leader in local investing? Locavesting, as our guest calls it, is gathering momentum around the country.
She says that locavesting isn't just about feeling virtuous. It's actually a moneymaker that helps your local economy and your bank account.
Amy Cortez joins us now. She's the former editor of Business Week and the author of Locavesting, The Revolution in Local Investing and How to Profit from It. She'll be in Madison on December 3rd to headline an event sponsored by Forward Community Investments. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
I want to start with Locavesting 101. What is it?
Okay, well, first the name. Yes, I made it up. And it's sort of a play on the term locavore. So if locavores eat a diet, a locally sourced diet, I'm talking about investing that way.
Well, with local eating, the idea is that you don't overtax the environment, you support the growers who live near you, and you maybe come away with a deeper investment in what you're eating. Is that the same basic argument for locavesting?
Sure, that's part of it. I mean, there's something broader going on, and I think a lot of this started in the food area because people, you know, were going to farmers markets and just wanting to feel more connected to their food producers and know where their food is coming from. And it's the same idea with investing. We've got this global, disembodied financial system, and we've really lost any sense of connection between our dollars and what they're invested in. So this is a way to kind of put that connection back, create a more intimate form of investment. And just like food can be sustainable, finance can be sustainable as well.
Why do you think that investing locally is picking up speed right now?
A lot of reasons. I mean, one of the major catalysts was the financial crisis. And I think a lot of people were just, you know, kind of outraged with the behavior of big banks on Wall Street, which took us to the brink of economic collapse, got a huge taxpayer bailout, and then just kind of skated away. And in fact, that taxpayer money was intended to encourage them to lend more. And instead, they did the opposite. They pulled back. They cut lines of credit for both businesses and individuals. So what we've seen since the financial crisis is a real credit crunch and funding crunch for small businesses. And these, you know, this is important because these small businesses and locally owned businesses are really the nation's true job creators.
You've said that Wisconsin is at the cutting edge of locavesting and that it's become a leader when it comes to the locavesting movement. Why is that? What's going on in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you have a lot going on there, and I'm excited to be visiting in a week or so. I'll start with Forward Community Investments, since they're hosting me there. And so FCI is an example of a community development loan fund. And this is one of the easiest ways that people can begin to invest locally and sort of, you know, dip a toe in the water by putting money into a revolving loan fund like Forward Community Investments have. It's kind of like a CD. You get, maybe 2% returns on your money, but you know that your money is very safe and it's being invested in enterprises in your community. And in fact, I'll be speaking at the Goodman Community Center, which I believe that Forward Community Investments helped to fund. So most areas do have a community development loan fund like that, but Madison has a lot more going on. I mean, first of all, you have the Green Bay Packers, right, the only community-owned NFL sports team. But you also have things like the Lion. There's a Madison Local Investing Opportunity Network run by Rebecca Ryan, and that's an idea that originated in Washington State, but it's when a group of residents get together and decide to invest their money locally. And they don't invest as a group, but companies in the region know that they can come to that group when they're looking for funding. So we've seen these crop up across the nation. There are about half a dozen of them now, but you have a very good one in Madison. You also have Slow Money Madison, and in my book I wrote about the Willie Street Co-op, which raised money from its members when it wanted to expand. Organic Valley raised $43 million from people who care about organic food when it expanded. So you have a lot going on. And, of course, the latest news is the crowdfunding bill that was signed into law just a week or so ago.
Right. And that was apparently only one of we're only one of three states that facilitate crowdfunding for in-state businesses. How does that work?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Let's. It might be helpful to just back up and clarify what crowdfunding is. So I like to think of it as the marriage of finance and social media. So instead of a business having to go to a bank or a venture capital firm or some institutional investor, they can reach out to their biggest fans, their customers, their friends and families, their supporters. And they can do that over the internet. So there are two basic types of crowdfunding. There's the donation and rewards type, where you're giving money in return for maybe a product or, you know, a T-shirt or some kind of reward. But there's no financial return. So we have lots of companies like Kickstarter is a very popular example of that type of donation crowdfunding. But there's also coming onto the scene what's being called equity crowdfunding or investment crowdfunding. And this was ushered in by the Jobs Act of 2012. It was signed into law in April 2012. And I was really honored, actually, to be in the Rose Garden for that signing. And I can tell you there was such an air of excitement when that law was being signed, because it really is the biggest and most transformational change to our securities laws since they were enacted in the 1930s. And without getting into a lot of detail, because securities laws are not a lot of fun, but before the Jobs Act, it was easier for most Americans to invest in a company halfway around the world than one in their own backyard. So that's not to say that all crowdfunding is local, but there are local forms arising, and I think it's just a really great tool that can really further local investing. So that's the Jobs Act. Now, as I said, it was signed into law in April 2012. The SEC just last month came out with the proposed rules that they were required to write that will govern this new industry. Now, those rules look pretty complicated, pretty onerous. And, you know, if you look at the range of Kickstarter, which is very simple and unregulated, to what we might have done here, it's more Merrill Lynch than Kickstarter. It's going to be heavily regulated.
All right. Well, I want to get into what the investors can get out of it when we come back. We're talking with Amy Cortez. She's the author of Locavesting, The Revolution in Local Investing and How to Profit from It.
And we welcome your questions and comments about how this works. And if you are a Locavester, someone who invests in local businesses, startups, why do you choose to put your money into local businesses? Or are you a local business person who's trying to start something up with local investors? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with about the local investing movement that's picking up steam here in Wisconsin and beyond. Our guest is Amy Cortez. She's the author of Locavesting, The Revolution in Local Investing and How to Profit from It.
And we welcome your questions, your comments on this. And are you a Locavester? Do you invest locally? Why do you choose your money to put your money into local businesses? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
Now, Amy, I want to look at the profit part of this. For somebody listening who's going, yeah, I could put my money into something local. I have to put a little more legwork into it, possibly, and I might not get as big a return as I would get from hunting big game on Wall Street. So where's the profit when you invest locally?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, and it's not easy to answer because it really depends on the situation and the investment. So something like a community development loan fund, which we started out talking about, that pays a steady, safe, you know, low 2-3%. Some of them go up to more than that. And, you know, frankly, in times of economic downturn, which we recently went through one, these actually end up being very good performing safe investments. And they're not linked with the volatility of the stock market. But, you know, let's take the Willie Street Co-op, and a lot of cooperatives do raise money this way from their members, and they often pay a dividend from like 6-8%, which is also very respectable. And Lions, you know, that can be a loan, it could be an investment, and, you know, these can range from low to, you know, a very good market rate or higher type return. So it really all depends.
And what would you say to someone who wanted to start off? What would be a good way to do this?
That's why I said I think the community development loan funds are one of the easiest ways that you can kind of dip a toe in the water of local investing. They're safe. They're not scary. Almost every region has one. And if anyone's listening from outside of Madison online, you can find a community development loan fund in your area by going to the Opportunity Finance Network, .org. They have a CDFI locator. So that's the easiest way. I always recommend banking locally as well. But I think with crowdfunding, we have a really exciting new opportunity here for people, and especially in the state of Wisconsin, which, as you said, is one of only three states that right now allow this interstate crowdfunding. And it's very new, so I don't know if anyone's taken advantage of it yet, but for example, in Georgia, there are now, which was one of the first two states to move on this, there are now two crowdfunding platforms that let any Georgia business raise money from any Georgia resident. And I think we'll see more of those.
Great. And yes, we are a statewide network, so lots of people all over the state who could be interested. And let's go to Jeannie, who is calling from Madison. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about an organization that we have here in Dane County called Dane Buy Local. We have 750 locally owned independent businesses that are our members. We cover Dane as well as the seven surrounding counties. It's a good, great way for local independent businesses to meet other folks that are as passionate as they are. We offer networking opportunities as well as access to resources for those businesses. We don't make any loans, but we can tell them who might be able to help them out.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Jeannie. And Amy, are you seeing lots of organizations like that cropping up?
Yes, I am, and I think the Buy Local organizations like Dane Buy Local really have an important role to play, and they already have played an important role in raising awareness about the importance of small business. And, you know, the Buy Local campaigns and the 10% shifts. So just as, shifting 10% of your purchasing to locally owned businesses can really benefit your community, I think the same is true for investing. So I think organizations like that can play a big role in continuing to raise awareness, but also bringing people together, as she mentioned.
Now, you've said that people can make a big difference by putting just 1% of their money into local businesses. How would that 1% change things?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that anyone put all of their money in locally owned companies, because the key with investing is you want to diversify. And, you know, let's face it, small businesses can be risky. But if you look at, on a macro scale, if you look at our investments in the U.S., Americans have $30 trillion invested in long-term securities. So our, you know, IRAs, 401ks, pension funds, things like that. And almost all of that, by default, is invested in the stocks and bonds of large publicly traded corporations. Because when you fill out your 401k form, there's no box to check for local companies, right? I mean, we just are not set up to invest that way. So right now, we systematically underfund locally owned companies, and these are companies that create jobs and really do so much for our communities in terms of creating wealth and well-being. So if you think about a 1% shift, just a 1% shift from, you know, where our investments are now into locally owned companies, that would represent $300 billion. And to put that into perspective, that's more than the entire value of loans outstanding to small businesses today, and it's about 10 times the amount of venture capital invested annually. Hmm. So a little bit can make a big difference.
How do you measure the success of locavesting?
That's a good question. I mean, there's certainly growing mind share. People are really talking about this, and I think the whole crowdfunding law changes are really giving it a lot more traction as well. But I think it's, it's hard to tally because it's very grassroots, and it's happening at the community level. And I hear stories all the time from people, who got inspired and invested in a local business. And these things have a major impact on the local economy. So I think it's just all of the, you know, the lion groups cropping up and the spread of slow money chapters and the increasing popularity of community development loan funds. I'd love to find a way to quantify it, but I think it's just so grassroots that it's kind of hard to get a sense of how much is actually happening.
Now, with local eating, a big part of what people say is that I get to look my farmer in the eye and I get to talk to them and I know them as a person and I feel differently about the food that I'm eating. Do you think that same thing is true about investing locally, that you get a closer tie with that business and it feels personal?
Yeah, it's very personal. I'm on the board of our local Slow Money chapter here, Slow Money NYC, and I see this all the time with people who, it's only for accredited investors, this one, so I unfortunately cannot participate in that, but I talk to, and I see all the time, investors who really have this connection to the entrepreneur and the small business or the farm that they've invested in, and they really, you know, in addition to, earning a financial return on it, they also feel really good about it and can actually see its success and share in the success. And the really wonderful thing for the businesses, by the way, is that these people who are your investors, the line kind of blurs between customer and investor, and they're just out there, you know, they're your brand ambassadors talking up your business. They're, you know, bringing their friends and their family in. So it's really kind of a win-win versus a winner-take-all kind of relationship.
All right. Well, Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, and I look forward to visiting.
That was Amy Cortese. She's the former editor of Business Week and the author of Locavesting.
Coming up next, we remember JFK on the 50th anniversary of his assassination. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. This is Central Time.